part of it's fatigue, just advertising fatigue. And you've got three main giants who control so much of it. And they're kind of just squeezing all of the juice out of it that they can with rising ad prices. But even my email inbox, I don't know about you, Mark, but I'm way more ruthless now with my email. I've got a ton of filters set up. I use like unroll.me to unsubscribe from a lot of stuff. Because you have to, because you know I'm looking to change my email address in the next couple months to just have a team address to really focus on, because it's the levels of messages coming at us are increasingly just they just keep going up and up and up.
Hi folks, it's the Quiet Light Podcast with Joe Valley and Mark Doust. Quiet Light Brokerage is the leader in helping entrepreneurs build, buy, and sell their online businesses. Since 2007, we have helped thousands buy and sell online businesses. And now, we're putting our extensive knowledge in your earbuds with our trademark relentless honesty and a few laughs along the way.
Just papers, my papers, business papers.
And what do you do, sir?
I'm unemployed.
And now, here's Joe and Mark.
Mark, back in Savannah, I think it was 2016, was the second time I ever went to E-commerce Fuel. And great location because I could drive there and it was in a beautiful, beautiful location. And I was so proud because I brought copies of my little book, my ebook, some would call it a booklet, called 10 Steps to Selling Your Amazon Business. And this is back in 16, we're talking, years ago. And so I thought I was at the forefront of things. And then Andrew does his presentation at the beginning of e-commerce fuel events, which was, really the state of e-commerce back then and what we've had him on the podcast about and what this podcast today is about. And what first thing he talks about is how few of the e-commerce fuel attendees are using Amazon, like less than 10%. And it was a very small part of their business, and that Shopify and other channels were much, much bigger. And I was slightly mortified. But then the next year, the biggest growth, I think in 2018 that we saw, actually, was it 17? Because we saw a state of the e-commerce from Andrew in 2018. The biggest growth factor was Amazon. And now that you've had him on again, I think that that's changed a little bit, right?
That's right. In this year's State of the Merchant Report from E-commerce Fuel, they've found that this is the first year that non-Amazon e-commerce stores outpaced Amazon as far as new sales channels, which is pretty amazing when you think about that. In fact, the quote directly is, "This was the first year non-Amazon sellers grew faster than those on the platform." So there's more growth happening off of Amazon among their members than on the Amazon platform. That's pretty remarkable to hear that, because it feels like everybody's on Amazon. And we've often preached this idea of having diverse revenue streams and making sure that you're being multi-channel with your revenue streams and platforms. But you and I know a lot of Amazon sellers that have gone all in on Amazon so that they can just focus on the growth there, get as much sales velocity there as they can, because it's easier to do than trying to manage multiple channels. But those who think that outside of Amazon, e-commerce is dead, it's not at all, not even close. There was a couple other interesting things that came out of this report, and I'm gonna let Andrew really get into some of the things that he found impressive. But one of the things that stood out to me was the effectiveness of Facebook as a marketing channel. It seems like everyone we talk to always says Facebook is such a great marketing channel, and if we could just figure it out. And what my experience has been is that everybody's trying to figure it out, right? Which means it's really difficult to actually do. I think those that have, quote unquote, figured it out are doing well. But among the people that responded to this really lengthy survey that Andrew puts them through, Facebook ads came in as the fifth most effective sales channel or advertising channel that people were reporting. And the ROAS, the median ROAS was a full point lower than the next highest. And again, we'll let Andrew talk about some of these things because I'm sure he has more insights than I do into the report itself. From just a general, like, where are you in the market as an e-commerce business, or when you're looking to buy and identifying the right trends and the types of businesses that are going to be around for the next several years, a report like this is just invaluable. Right? You get to see where business is going, where the industry is going, and maybe where the next opportunities lie.
Yeah, it comes directly from the e-commerce fuel membership database. As far as I understand it, Andrew sends a survey out and collects all of this data and all of this information. So it's from real entrepreneurs down in the trenches, running their businesses, physical product e-commerce businesses. So if anybody's out there that is, you know, looking to grow their business outside of Amazon, this report can help. If anybody's buying a business and wants to take it beyond Amazon, this report can help. If you're on Shopify and you want to learn the other channels, what number 2, 3, and 4 are before that fifth one that's most effective being Facebook, this report can help. And it comes from Andrew. There's very few people in the industry that are as good a character as Andrew and folks at e-commerce feel.
I was just about to say that. Shout out for the good guys. Andrew is definitely one of those. So let's get to this discussion between he and I on this report and find out what some of the insights he pulled away were.
Let's go to it.
Andrew, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. You were on last year. We talked about the awesome report that you guys do over at E-commerce Fuel, the State of the Merchant Report, and this is where you survey a lot of the members of your community, which, you know, we've talked about here on the Quiet Light Podcast. Joe and I talk about it quite a bit. One of our favorite conferences, one of our favorite communities out there for high revenue e-commerce store owners. Just think it's a fantastic community that you built there. And you do this report every year. It's a really good pulse of what's going on in the world of e-commerce. So thank you again for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it. And good work with the podcast. I've been enjoying the Quiet Light Podcast, caught a number of episodes, and you guys are putting out good stuff, you and Joe. But I don't know, your episodes seem to have just a tiny edge on Joe's. I don't know, maybe that's just in my mind, but regardless, you guys are doing awesome stuff. So
yeah, I'm just going to record that. I'm going to put it on loop, and I'm just going to send it to Joe a few times so he can hear that over and over again. That's great. If you need to submit at some point, we've been adding these movie quotes to our intros at random. So you need to listen to those and tell us what you think it is. We'll give you a shout out. although I never know what they are myself. So I'm excited about this. I'm excited to talk about this year's report, because you always come out with just some really fascinating bits of data. And I want to start with one that I've run across a decent amount, because I think it really, it speaks to a lot of buyers are thinking about when they're evaluating an online purchase, and also sellers who are looking to scale their business. And this is, what is providing the best return on investment at this point in terms of advertising? Facebook is often quoted, you know, if we could just unlock Facebook, and this is something that I want to get into a little bit here. But your report showed some surprising numbers with where the most value is and where some of that lowest hanging fruit is for advertising.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that this is new this year. I wanted to take a look at what merchants are using the most in terms of promoting their business. So what's most popular, but then also what's the most effective, because often those are not the same thing. And so you look at the most popular marketing channels, and we just ask people, what are you using? And you know, in the number of popularity, first was email marketing, second Facebook ads, third was Google AdWords, fourth was SEO, and fifth was Instagram. And so then we of course, it was a popularity. To get a sense of what was most effective, we looked at, okay, of the people that are using every single one of, you know, these things we asked about, what percentage of them ranked that specific one as the most effective? And the one that came to the surface wasn't even in the top five that we talked about. The number one most effective marketing channel reported by merchants was Amazon ads. Over half of people running Amazon ads said it was the best, highest ROI marketing channel that they used. Number two was email marketing, three was SEO, fourth was Google AdWords, and at like a distant fifth, not even like a close fifth, but a distant fifth was Facebook ads. And another thing that we explored was the average return on ad spend for, you know, Facebook ads versus Amazon and Google. And they had the lowest return on ad spend at 3.4 compared to Amazon at 4.6 and Google at over 5. And their increase, you know, the costs on the Facebook platform were going up the fastest as well, almost 20% versus 16 for Amazon and 10 for Google. So those were, you know, that was kind of the Facebook, I think a lot of people, so many people are doing it. And it's easy to have like almost like some fear of missing out if you're not doing it, or if you're doing it, feel like you're not getting the secret when everyone else is. But I think it's a harder nut to crack than people like to admit. So anyway, those are some of the numbers we saw in the advertising.
Yeah, there's a lot that I want to get into on this here, and let's see if I can remember all of it. But I want to first talk about the Facebook ads, because you put it in that way. It's a tough nut to crack. And I wonder if that's really maybe some of the secret that's going on behind these numbers with the average ROAS and also the effective marketing channel. You know, we've had Ezra Firestone on the podcast here before. He's a friend of Quiet Light Brokerage. He obviously is a big advocate of Facebook advertising. I've seen some other people who have been doing Facebook ads with a lot of effectiveness. But, and this is the big caveat, it takes a while to figure that part out. And a lot of these guys that have gotten there, where they're seeing these ROASs of 5+, they've taken months, literally months, and lots of dollars down the drain to really get to that point. I'm wondering, and maybe you looked into this a little bit with the survey, did you look into people that had tried Facebook marketing and maybe gave up after 2 or 3 months because they couldn't get it to work? Or did you not look that deep or ask that deep of a question?
Yeah, I didn't go quite that deep, and it's always tough designing the survey because it's already, you know, like 50 plus questions, and I'm trying to balance making sure we get people to get all the way through it with, you know, what are the critical things we need. So sadly, I didn't get that kind of data. A lot of the kind of the thoughts and the stories behind people getting into Facebook and having a hard time with it are more anecdotal that I hear from people. So sadly, yeah, I wish I had some good numbers and data behind it, but it's more anecdotal than anything else.
Yeah. And I mean, look, there's a couple things on here. Your top five: Amazon ads, email marketing, SEO, and Google AdWords. So let's go through here with Amazon ads, SEO, Google AdWords. Those are all high intent advertising channels, right? So somebody goes online and says, buy shoes, or buy cheap shoes, or best running shoes. That's a really high intent search. Facebook ads, not so much of a high intent search. The email marketing side, if they're on your list, they're already a warm contact. So right. It shouldn't be too surprising that we're seeing that. But the other side of this too, that I would say is, like, if you're looking to create a market, and let's say you have kind of an odd channel, maybe you take a spin on a new type of ice cream scooper that doesn't get stuck ever, right? So the ice cream never gets stuck in that ice cream scooper, and you've invented this and you're going to sell it. Well, nobody knows that it exists. So it might take a while to build that market. And so a Facebook ads might be a good source for that, because you can have that proof of concept and really kind of educating the marketplace, but it's also going to take a little bit more work to get people to really pique their attention. Yeah.
Yeah, at Facebook, it's just a totally different mindset for advertising. It's really great if you're good at targeting. If you're good at the way you build a funnel, is just totally different. It's more so about, you got to be able to catch people when they're doing something else, get their attention, pull them off the platform, or engage them for a while and then pull them off, versus being able to drive a sale short term. It's I feel like it's a longer term game, and it's just a different mentality you need to have if you're going to do it well. And targeting too with Facebook, I think, is getting trickier. I've heard, again, no data for this, but just anecdotally, even this last month or two, that some of the targeting, the traffic that Facebook's been sending, hasn't been converting as well for some members and some people I know. And so that's a big part of Facebook performing well, is you know, them sending you people that, based on their intelligence, they know are going to work well. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, my tough nut to crack, I think, is the best way to describe it. So I do think it's a viable source, but you got to have the right type of product, and you really have to know what you're doing with it, and be patient. I mean, that's just a lot with these. Amazon, I'm not surprised at all. Still a very young marketplace, so I think we're still seeing kind of those numbers equalize out. Talk about a high intent marketplace and high intent searches. I think that makes complete sense that they're number one on the list. And let's give a shout out to email marketing, probably the old man in the room there, right?
Yeah. Although it's funny, I think about, you know, you look at email and even email, it's still, of course, it's, you know, the number two most effective marketing channel and still highly super valuable. But I feel like even broadly, it's getting harder. Just, I think advertising in general is getting so much more difficult. because we've had so much of it. Part of it's fatigue, just advertising fatigue, and you've got three main giants who control so much of it, and they're kind of just squeezing all of the juice out of it that they can with rising ad prices. But even my email inbox, I don't know about you, Mark, but I'm way more ruthless now with my email. I've got a ton of filters set up. I use like unroll.me to unsubscribe from a lot of stuff. Because you have to, because, you know, I'm looking to change my email address in the next, you know, couple, you know, months to just have a team address to really focus on, because it's, you know, the levels of messages coming at us are increasingly just, you know, they just keep going up and up and up. And so I don't know, it'll be interesting to see if anything comes up in the next, you know, 2, 3, 4 years where you know, that makes it able to get through all of that noise, because it's getting just, I think advertising in general is just getting a lot harder because there's just so much out there.
Yeah. I really think it comes down to that personalization. Email marketing, you're right. I mean, email it's a complete mess. And now I use Gmail, we use Gmail or Google apps throughout Quiet Light Brokerage, and they tab everything down in that promotions or updates or forums tab. And I'll tell you what, I don't look at promotions ever. Like, yeah. That is like, oh, basically it's spam light is what it is. And so you just throw all that stuff away. I go through every few days and select all and hit archive. Cutting through that, though, like having personalized messages, very, very hyper-focused, hyper-personalized messages, I think that's really the only way that people are going to be able to survive with that email marketing. And that's tough. That's not easy to do.
No, I agree. And I think, I did a podcast with somebody earlier this year, and they have an antiques business, and every week they send out an email on Saturday, and the click-through rates are like 25%, and talk to him about how he was doing this and trying to get some secret out of it. And there wasn't any secret. It was that, you know, he spent hours and hours and hours on an email that was totally unique, and it was an amazing deep interest level to the customers, and people open it. And like, I look at the email that we have that goes out to our private community of stores, and it's not nearly as good as his is, but it goes out to a much smaller group, only about 1,000 people. But, you know, we're able to get, and it takes a lot of time to put together, but it, you know, it gets generally open rates of close to 50%.
Let's move on here to another thing. I want to talk about the anatomy of a store owner. You put together a really nice infographic on the link to the report. And I will link to this report here in the show notes, and we'll also throw it into an email as well. So people listening to this, you know, take a look at the email coming through from Quiet Light Brokerage. But I want to talk about the makeup of the store owner. Dropshipping seems to be kind of on the losing end of things these days.
Yeah, I feel like it's had some pretty strong headwinds for the last couple of years. And this year, the number every year we ask, you know, we look at what percentage of store owners are a certain type of business model, dropshipping, manufacturing, private label, hybrid, or reselling products. And this year, the number of dropshippers that reported got cut in half. So only 8% of people this year, down from 16% last year, were dropshippers, which is a pretty huge, just a massive cut. And if you look at the number of manufacturers that were reporting that reported for the survey this year, that was up by almost a third, by 32%. So it seems like a lot of those, you know, I feel like this has been kind of a narrative that's been talked about for a couple of years now, but it's really playing out in the numbers.
Yeah, I think so as well. What's funny though is we had somebody on recently to talk about dropshipping, and they were killing it. They were doing a great job with dropshipping. So I feel like it's one of these areas where for a while there were AdSense sites, if you remember, a bunch of AdSense sites all over the place. A bunch of those got wiped out, and the general thought was this is kind of a dead business model. Well, I've seen some of them come by, and those people that actually survived through that, wow, they got some strong, strong businesses. I feel that way with dropshipping a little bit. Like, if you can survive these headwinds, you've got something good.
It's funny you say that, Mark, because when I looked at the revenue growth by business model and the income growth by business model, guess who was leading the pack on both of those metrics? It was dropshippers. And I think what happened is exactly like you said, there's a little bit of a Darwinism at play here where, you know, a lot of the herd got thinned out, and the people that were left were able to make it work well. And I think you're absolutely right. It definitely can work in some models. I think it's much harder to get the things to all align and get a model where it works well for reasons that, you know, I don't know if you necessarily want to get into on the show right now. But if you can get it right, I mean, it's a great business model because, I mean, no inventory, no upfront cash, no cash flow issues, location independent. If you get to work right, it's a pretty good gig.
Yeah, it really is. But it seems to be so dependent on the product and then also your relationships as well. Because obviously the problem with dropshipping competition, it's so easy just to spin up something and compete directly with you. And you get this sort of ubiquitous sort of marketplace of every product's exactly the same, same images, everything else. Boy, it's tough. It's tough to work in that area. On the flip side, so like I like to think about this on a spectrum, right? We have on one side, we have drop shipping where you never even see the product. Sometimes you get into reselling, which might be a little bit of a step away from that drop shipping where you're still dealing with some physical product, but it's not yours. And then you go all the way over to the other side of the spectrum and you get these unique manufactured products, some of them private label, but the most extreme would be, hey, I invented something or I've created a product. And you're seeing some pretty big gains in that area.
Yeah. I mean, the number of manufacturers, like I mentioned, was up a third this year. And if you look at also not just the number of people that are doing it, but the benefits that they're seeing and the payoff. So we track margins, you know, gross margin and net margin for those, for all these different types of sellers. And manufacturers had by far the largest gross margin at 53%, the highest net margin at 21%. And those were up year over year too for each category. I think gross margin for manufacturers was up from 45% up to 53%, and the net was up as well. So I think manufacturers it's harder business. There's less of a roadmap. It's more capital intensive. It's more stressful, but if you're able to crack it, more and more people are going that way. It's really the only way I feel like you can play on Amazon these days. Cause if you're going to try to go resell someone else's product on Amazon, you're going to get destroyed. And it's where a lot of people seem to be going and getting paid for it. So,
yeah, I think, all those things that you talked about, the stress, no roadmap, everything else, there's a flip side to that. It's defensible, right? Because there's no roadmap, you're not going to have everybody saying, oh, I know exactly how to do this. It is difficult to do, and figuring out how to get that manufacturing component done is tough. Did you ask people, and if you only have just kind of from what you've heard in the community, obviously China, I would guess, would be the number one sourcing location for most people manufacturing. What other countries are you hearing from some of the members in the community that where people are sourcing product, especially, you know, when we're recording this? I don't know when we're going to air this episode, but when we're recording this, we're staring down potentially more tariffs going on with China. Mm-hmm. Obviously, this is going to impact everybody selling from China. So finding other sources would be great. Have you heard of any other countries that seem to be emergent?
That's a great question. And the honest answer is no. I mean, there's people in Asia. I hear occasionally about people sourcing in Taiwan, which, you know, depending on who you ask, is China or isn't. Vietnam is another one that comes up. But apart, and you have, you know, some people I know occasionally here and there source from India or make their things in Canada, or some, you know, someone I'd met with recently is building some stuff, some footwear in Mexico. So there definitely are some other places people get certain things. But in terms of a potential runner-up to China that could even remotely start to be an alternative to where people are manufacturing 90% of things, I don't think of someone who's pulling away or even, you know, accelerating at all. It's kind of just a whole bunch of a lot of different options all over. So no, not really an emerging source for manufacturing that I'm seeing.
That's a little disappointing, but not surprising, right? I mean, boy, wouldn't it be great to have something on this side of the ocean where we could maybe just pull up from Central America instead of having to, you know, I talked to some of these store owners and they're talking about 3 month plus lead times where you're committing capital and then that goes on the ocean and takes, oh, I can't imagine how difficult that would be.
Oh, it'd be really hard. And, you know, it's one thing we did ask this year was, did tariffs impact your business? And granted, I know we're talking, you know, you and I are both in the States. I know a lot of people listening aren't in the States, but for probably, you know, the vast majority of, I think it's 85%-ish or so of respondents for this survey were, you know, are US based, or 75% rather. But we asked, you know, did tariffs impact your business this year? And, you know, over a third of people, 36%, said the tariffs like meaningfully hurt their business this year. And like you just alluded to, they're only getting more from slapped on. So it's a big deal. And it'd be nice to have a silver lining, maybe be that sourcing out of some of the countries closer to us, maybe get a boost.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Hey, if anybody has an idea on where we can crack that nut, let me know. That'd be great. We can figure that part out. Let's go to some of the sunny news here. And that is, everything seems to be growing. I started Quiet Light Brokerage right before we hit that great recession. So a lot of my entrepreneurial journey has been slogging through a difficult economy. It seems like from what we're seeing, we're in a bull market right now.
It seems really strong. So we, looking at growth rates over time, and again, these are the average merchant, the average e-commerce store owner reporting for the survey was right around 3 million. So that's relatively small when you look at the macro economy. I think if you look at e-commerce trends in general, they're probably going to be growing closer to 20%-ish plus or minus. But for this segment of store owners, you look at the growth trend over 3 years, 2017, it was about 25%. Last year, it jumped way up to 30, almost 37%. And this year, it was down a touch to 36%, but still really, meaningfully about the same. So revenue growth is good. Income growth has also, remained real strong. And you look at the conversion rate too, and it's just continued to go up the last 2 years. I mean, the average conversion rate we were looking at this year was over 3%, up from 2.62% last year. And in terms of, like I talked about earlier, margins are up. So all in all, for store owners, things are good. Growth is good. Margins are good. Conversion is great. And it's kind of a, I don't know, boom time is the right word, but it's definitely, things are robust and healthy out there for stores in this segment.
Yeah, that's fantastic. One of the surprising things that I've seen from the report, and we talked about this last year, and I know Joe tells me, and we mentioned this in the introduction to this episode here, that the very first e-commerce Fuel Live that he attended, he brought a book on 10 Steps to Sell on Amazon Business. And you ask at one point, you raise your hand if you're selling on Amazon. And it was only a small portion of the room that did so. And he's thinking, well, man, I completely missed the mark bringing this book to this event. But we've seen this number increase over the years. Although this year, unless I've got dyslexia and I'm reading this backwards, looks like you have a decline in people that are selling on Amazon and an increase in people that are not selling on Amazon. Is that really what you're seeing?
Yeah, I wouldn't say a decline, but I would say a plateauing of something in the report that I wrote up. I'm calling plateauing Amazon. I hesitate to use the word peak Amazon because every time that I think that they've peaked at anything, they just blow up and accelerate to the moon. But looking at let's take three examples here or three data points. If you look at the number of merchants who they either sell on Amazon or they don't. A couple of years ago, 49%. Last year, it was 55%. So a fairly meaningful jump. This year, that number barely budged. It went from 55.2% to 55.8%. So up a little bit, but wildly decelerating. Along the same lines, if you look at group sales from Amazon last year, 2 years ago, they were up really sharply, and this year they barely budged. So, 27.6 to 28.2% of the total sales that all of the merchants generate coming from Amazon. And this is maybe the most surprising number. If you look at just the revenue growth of stores that sell on Amazon versus don't, last year, stores that sold on Amazon grew faster than stores that didn't. And this year, stores that don't sell on Amazon actually grew faster than stores that do by a small margin, and which is just really, really surprising. So I think that there's so much here we could do a whole episode on. I don't think Amazon is going anywhere. I think they're going to be shaping the e-commerce landscape for the next 5 to 10 years. But I do think a lot of merchants are starting to really struggle with counterfeit issues, with increasing fees, with loss of control, with feeling like they're totally beholden to Amazon, and a lot of host other issues. And they're not getting off the platform, but the number of merchants that are saying, hey, yeah, let's go hitch our wagon solely to Amazon and sell there. And some people are just deciding to leave the platform altogether. So one of my predictions in here, I'm almost certainly going to be wrong because I'm going out on a limb, but is that next year is the first year we see the percentage of stores selling on Amazon actually decrease year over year. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder if shoppers' behavior is changing at all. And, just again, this can't draw any conclusions from this here. But I know for myself, I've become more of a diversified shopper than I have in the past. Now, I still use Amazon, probably like 4 or 5 times a week. I'm still a really heavy Amazon shopper. But I'll actually look around a little bit off Amazon as well. And if I get the chance to order directly from a store, I do so. Now, that's probably just because I work with so many entrepreneurs that have these stores, and I know benefits for them. But there's something nice about that specialization, right? So you think about the big box stores and how they couldn't specialize in any sort of gear. But if you want something high-end and specialized, it makes sense to go to somebody that actually does specialize in that. This is pure speculation on my part, of course.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I think we're going to see the next 5 years a real hollowing out of e-commerce where you have Amazon. If there's something you know you want to buy, it's somewhat of a commodity or a fairly inexpensive product that, you know, I think Amazon's going to be the place you go to get it quickly and cheaply and efficiently. But I think for anything else, for merchants that I think the place to really thrive and survive over the next 5 years is to have a premium product or a very niche product, ideally one that you manufacture. Like just for example, yesterday I called up and I was in the market for, you know, a nice bike rack for my vehicle. And I went out and did a lot of research, and the company I ended up buying it from, I ended up talking to them on the phone for 35, 40 minutes. They custom manufactured it in the United States. They shipped it to me, and it's the kind of thing. They have an incredible product, and they don't sell on Amazon, surprisingly, because they don't need to, because everyone that wants this site, you know, or this product, they go right to them, and they don't want to give up the margin or the loss of control, I'm guessing. And I think those are the kind of merchants that are going to do really well the next, you know, 5+ years. And I think I think that's kind of the best place to be going forward if you're not going to be on Amazon.
Yeah, I would agree 100%. I think just from, again, that long-term sort of defensibility mindset, it's what I've seen. And I actually see it on Amazon as well. The companies that are doing really, really well long-term on Amazon really care about their products. And they're spending a lot of time in that product development cycle, doing their research, trying to make sure that they have something that's a high-quality product. But then they're also looking outside of that as well and becoming specialists in that space, which makes a big difference. With everything that you surveyed here, was there any one or two things that really stood out to you as being surprising this year or would inform you if you were an owner of an e-commerce business yourself that you would definitely want to take action on?
I think the big things were the massive shift, and we kind of touched on these, but the massive shift of people going away from dropshipping and into manufacturing and the benefits financially that those manufacturers were seeing. That would be a big one. The other one was the Facebook ones we talked about, where Facebook ads really are you know, definitely at the back of the pack, especially relative to their popularity in terms of effectiveness. So those would be probably two of the big things. And then in terms of Amazon, I think it can make sense. You know, if you have a great product that's proprietary, it doesn't, you know, if you do it carefully, I don't think you shouldn't go on Amazon, but just the fact that so many people are kind of hitting the brakes on that, or at least new entrants into the Amazon aren't rushing in as headlong as they were before, I think is pretty telling. So nothing new there, Mark, that we haven't talked about, but those three things, if I was in the middle of kind of defining strategy or starting it from scratch, I think would be things I'd think pretty carefully about.
Yeah, you said earlier in the episode here with advertising how much more difficult it's become. And I generally think that what we're seeing with the internet and internet-based businesses, and we've been seeing this pretty much since the time I started as an entrepreneur 20 years ago now, is this maturation of the businesses where I think they're all getting more difficult to do. And, you know, you look at this and you think, oh man, that's such a bummer. I know I talked to some friends who are entrepreneurs, you know, back in the early 2000s, and we kind of reminisce about the glory days of I was able to spin up a website, wait for the Google Dance to happen, and now all of a sudden I'm making, you know, gobs of money. But what do we learn from all of that? We learn that dries up and disappears pretty quickly. The people that are surviving are the ones that are embracing some of these challenges and looking at them saying, I'm going to build something real, sustainable, real product, and they're doing great. They're doing really good. And that bears out in some of your numbers.
Yeah. And one thing, absolutely, absolutely does. And I think one thing too, to touch on in terms of Amazon, in terms of, you know, kind of sourcing and more of a macro level, if you look at one of the things we asked was, what are you know, your most common struggles, what macro changes are you seeing, and what are your future plans? And one of the macro changes that came up the first time this year on the top list was the number of Chinese sellers that were coming into Amazon. And I think I saw a stat today that 40% of the top Amazon sellers in 2019 are Chinese sellers versus 26% 2 years ago. And so on one level, you have, you know, just a lot more competition directly from factories who are the low-cost provider, which isn't a bad thing for consumers in and of itself, but it's harder for merchants. And if those sellers don't have the same kind of quality standards, some of them do, some of them don't, then you also run into problems. But you also have a lot of, one thing I've noticed is a lot of counterfeit issues. This has been in the news. We've had a number of members in our community who have had problems with this, where they had a product, it got knocked off. And then these people, you know, a lot of overseas sellers started selling this product directly in competition with the original manufacturer, which was really problematic because the quality wasn't as good. And so consumers got it, and it really hurt the brand because they assumed it came from the original source when it didn't. And so you're seeing, I think this is also ties back into Amazon, why people are getting a little bit more careful about that platform, is because there's some meaningful counterfeit issues out there that, again, going back to the difficulties of manufacturing that merchants are having to face, that weren't really as much of an issue 2-3 years ago.
It'd be interesting to see what happens with that platform. And also, I'm going to touch on one last bit of the report here that you spent some time on, and that is the impact of politicians and judges. And you covered two areas. We already talked about tariffs briefly and how many people were impacted by that. I think the other big elephant in the room, and it's been there for several years, we've talked about it a ton here at Quiet Light Brokerage, and that is the FBA nexus, right? Mm-hmm. Do you have nexus? Are you filing those sales taxes in different states? And you still have a very small percentage, relatively speaking, of your community that is paying those sales taxes. I think 24% is what I'm seeing. Is that right?
Yep, that's correct. So the percentage of sellers who have Amazon inventory that are filing for sales tax and submitting sales tax in any state that they have, you know, FBA nexus, quote unquote, whether or not you agree that's, you know, a legitimate claim to nexus. Yeah, only about a quarter of merchants are submitting sales tax to those states.
Do you have any idea why such a small percentage? I mean, obviously nobody wants to pay taxes, right? And that it's a pain. Do most people? I've run into sellers who make the argument it's really not owed. There's no legal basis for it.
I think it's a couple of things. I think one, it is potentially disputable whether or not. And again, this is something I need to personally do a deep dive on. But from the very, you know, this is where things get dangerous when I talk, right? But from the very little I know, I don't believe it's a very crystal clear. There's a whole lot of precedent saying yes, this does definitively give you nexus. And it's going to be a state-by-state issue as well. So I think that's part of it. I think the second part of it is thinking about, so because it's a gray area, you're going to have more people who start to think about it on a risk basis. Like, what are my risks if I submit? What are my risks if I don't? Also, relative to the workload, because it's not just about the tax. Like, I mean, if it was mostly about the tax and the administering this and the managing of it was really easy, I think, and you didn't have any, you know, long-term liability or exposure to being audited, I think most merchants would say, hey, a little inconvenience, but, you know, let's go ahead and let's set this up. You know, you snap your fingers, I'll collect the sales tax, not a big deal. If it's at a federal level, much easier to do. I think you'd see that number jump from 25 to, you know, 50% plus, but that's not the case. Like, you know, you've got, it's hard to administer. You potentially open yourself up to dozens, hundreds, maybe even theoretically thousands of different municipalities who can audit you. You run the risk of getting on a sales tax agency's radar to come after you when maybe you weren't before. So I think those are some of the reasons why people are not exactly thrilled at the thought of jumping in and waving their hand to tax agencies and saying, hey, here I am. I'm not sure if I actually legally am obligated to do this, but come check me out.
Yeah, right. No, and I completely get it. I get the risk versus reward analysis. And frankly, if I were a seller, I would probably be among that 75% that's not collecting. Not that that's what I would advise here in my role, because I know that if you do want to sell, you got to be doing that, right? Most buyers are looking at that saying, yeah, we want you to be paying those taxes. We don't want that to come back after us and haunt us later on. But I mean, for my opinion, I think it's pretty legally shaky ground to say that people do have that nexus. But the best practice from a selling standpoint would be to be filing. So we do, I mean, that's our default position here at Quiet Light, is that you should be filing for sure, well, without a doubt. But I would love to see this resolved within the next few years, because it's as if Amazon sellers don't have enough things hanging over their head. There's this potential, like you said, of being audited by the state of California, or all of a sudden getting a bill for 7, 8, 9 years of taxes. What a mess. You know, they need to get together and figure this part out.
There's a little bit of encouraging news, and this is a different sales tax issue. We're talking about the FBA Nexus tax issue, but the Wayfair versus South Dakota Supreme Court case that opened up the doors for states to tax inbound orders to their residents, even if you don't have Nexus in the state, as a whole, opened up a whole other can of worms. And California, I believe, just passed some legislation that increased the threshold for, I think that the term for that is economic nexus. They bumped that up meaningfully to $500,000, when before it was really low at 100,000 and 200 transactions. So there's a little bit of encouraging news on some of that fronts. And I believe there's been maybe half a dozen other states that have either followed suit or are in process of doing that. But it's sales tax right now in the United States is just an absolute disaster. And I agree with you. I think we really need something at the federal level to clean it up, because it's just a nightmare. I know people, I know you have too, Mark, that have sold their business, not entirely based on, but this definitely was a large part of the calculation, thinking through, I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to deal with the stress. I don't want to deal with the liability. And this is making business harder than it needs to be. And I'm ready to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we got to get to the most important metric that you got and then wrap this up, because we're actually long already with the episode. You know what it is. It's your KPI, the thing that you're focusing on the most. And in the past, you've learned stuff about your community. You'd rather be attacked by a swarm of angry bees than a bear. And you say that they're crazy. I don't know. A bear sounds pretty scary. But this year you asked, what luxury gift would you pick? Unlimited use of a private jet, $300,000 in annual income, monthly lunch with anyone, or a tropical island in a house. So that 300K of annual income, is that like forever?
That's forever. Yeah. And I think I overly weighted this one. I should have been a little stingier with the annual annuity that you got, because 2/3 of people picked the 300K income, which, it's hard to argue against. That's pretty sweet little setup for life. But about 10% picked the jet, about 13% picked the monthly lunch with anyone. That was my pick. I think to be able to sit down once a month with the likes of, US presidents, heads of state, Nobel Prize winners. I mean, you can't buy that. I think that'd be cool.
Do you have to buy lunch?
You do. I should have included that. That was probably what was the deal breaker for me.
Right. I mean, because it's got to be a pretty nice lunch if you're going to have lunch with these guys. You're not just going down to like Mickey D's.
That's a good point. And then the last one was a tropical house. About 13% of people picked it. But yeah, I mean, I feel like this is kind of the cornerstone. I'm surprised we didn't lead with this one, actually, Mark. I think next time maybe we mix things around and lead off with the Kardashian performance syndicate.
I like to always put the best content at the end so that people listen all the way to the end. Because I mean, where would your day be today if you hadn't learned that most people would take 300K annual income over monthly lunch with anyone? I actually think you make a pretty valid point there. That would be pretty valuable. You can't buy a monthly lunch with anyone. That'd be tough.
No, I mean, Buffett, I think you can buy lunch with Buffett for, I don't know, it's in the millions, I think, to have lunch with him. And he's just, granted, he's a pretty cool cat, but to be able to do that monthly with anyone, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Alive and dead?
No, I don't think alive. I think it'd have to be alive. I didn't put that in there. If we had summoning abilities to be able to, resurrect people, that would be pretty sweet. I put that in there too. I probably would have bumped it up a touch, but I don't know. That 300K was pretty appealing to people. People like their cash.
I think I could probably make 300K a year with summoning abilities. I'd be like one of those fortune tellers, but I'm pretty sure I could spin that off into a pretty nice.
I bet you could too.
Hey, thanks so much for coming on. Tons of really good information. Go check out ecommercefuel.com and the State of the Merchant Report. We will link to it in the show notes. We will be sending out an email to every one of our subscribers here on this. If you're not a member of the community, are you taking applications right now, Andrew?
We are. Yes, we are. Yep.
Okay. If you're not a member of the e-commerce fuel community and you are an e-commerce seller, you definitely need to check them out. I don't recommend a lot of groups. I don't recommend a lot of people or sites. We do so very stingily here at Quiet Light Brokerage, but E-commerce Fuel is one of our favorite groups out there. So please do check them out. Anything you'd like to end with, Andrew?
No, I think that maybe two quick things. One, if you want to check out the report directly, it's ecommercefuel.com/2019-report. That'll link you right to it. And then if you happen to be a podcast listener, which I'm guessing you are, also do a weekly podcast, sometimes twice a week, on e-commerce, e-commerce news, interviews with store owners, you know, kind of cutting edge, just whatever's happening in the e-commerce world and strategy. And that comes out weekly as well. So if you're interested in that, you can check that out wherever you get your podcasts.
Yep. And you guys also send out really good emails. I know we talked about email marketing. There's not a lot of people I feel add value to my inbox. I think you guys do a great job of adding value to my inbox. So definitely check out the community, check out the podcast and the report. And once again, Andrew, thanks for coming on. I look forward to having you on next year for the 2020 State of the Merchant Report.
Yeah, thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. It's always fun to come on and great work with what you guys are doing in the online space with businesses. So it's always fun to talk and appreciate the invite.
Today's podcast was produced by Podcast Motor and the Quiet Light Content Team. If you have a suggestion for a future podcast, or if you want to guess the quote from the beginning of the show for a chance at getting a shout out on the pod, email us at podcast@quietlightbrokerage.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook, and subscribe to our YouTube channel and this show wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.